Insperity presents the Small Business Advocate Show with Jim Blasingame. This is a copyrighted production of Small Business Network, Inc. All rights reserved.
Welcome back. It's 12 after the hour. Thank you very much for hanging out with me. Thanks for being part of my day. I'm Jim Blasingame, and you're listening to the Small Business Advocate Show, and I'm glad you're here. Martin Wolf is here, too, ladies and gentlemen. He's a new friend. I'm glad he's joining us. Martin is Associate Editor and Chief Economic Commentator at the Financial Times in London. He is the author of a number of books, including Why Globalization Works, and his new book is called The Shifts and Shocks, What We've Learned and Have Still to Learn from the Financial Crisis, and he's here to talk to us about that very topic. Martin Wolf, welcome to the show.
Hey, it's a pleasure to be on it.
It's good to have you here. He joins us all the way from London. I meant to say that. Martin, thanks for joining us. Get you to comment on three things in your book that you identify as the great shifts that you said contributed to the financial crisis: liberalization of finance, technology, and you call it aging. I think of it as demographic behavior, but talk to us about those three things. You say those were the three great shifts.
Well, actually, there is another one which I think in a way is even more important, which is globalization.
Mm-hmm.
Had two enormous consequences. It had effects, of course, on distribution of income and wages.
Mm-hmm.
In Western countries, particularly the United States, that was reinforced by technological changes, and that made people increasingly debt dependent for their in order to sustain their standard of living. People became increasingly inclined to borrow. And it had another effect. Globalization had another effect, which was that it generated, in a rather complicated process, absolutely gigantic flows of savings, surplus capital, which was just the other side of huge current account surpluses, particularly in Asia and particularly in China. So that
in the West, but more in the East, right?
Yeah. So what was happening is that the U.S. became a huge capital importer. At the same time, corporations were unwilling to invest for a whole host of reasons after the stock bubble burst. And so the way policymakers effectively found, and not just in America but also elsewhere, to provide the demand that would offset the weak corporate investment and these huge capital flows coming, huge deficits in the current account and therefore capital flows coming from Asia, the way they found it, it was sort of serendipity, was these big house buys booms that encouraged lots of borrowing, encouraged lots of spending.
There was plenty of
and
cash.
And then you got this last element, the liberalization of finance, which of course allowed this tremendous credit boom to become, I think, the biggest, most destructive credit boom probably in history.
And that, in my view,
in a nutshell, is what caused the crisis.
And we got so dependent upon it that when the money started running out, we started leveraging it beyond that. We didn't just stop when the money slowed down, right? Because some of these financial instruments, these mortgages, the home buying mortgages you were talking about, the mortgages for those homes, especially the subprimes, those were leveraged 70-1 in some places. So the digital greed got involved in that too, didn't it?
Well, that is to me the core of the credit boom story. If you're going to get people to spend so much more than their incomes for so long, and remember, so many people did, then somebody has to be to create the credit, and the way the credit system creates credit is through leverage. And that is the system itself. And in those times, both the non-financial sector got massively more leverage, much more household borrowing above, above all, so the balance sheets of households became much more leveraged. But, of course, the financial sector also became massively more leveraged. There wasn't more equity in the system. So what happened is, roughly speaking, the leverage in the financial sector as a whole increased two or three times. So when the correction came, we discovered that many of the most important financial institutions of the world had next to no capital. They had no sparing capacity, and then, of course, we got a panic.
And that's exactly what happened. And so then the government came in and started bailing out everyone, or most people, and they rushed it with monetary support, which most believe was essential to preventing a global meltdown, even worse than it was. But even though the patient didn't die, Martin, it's still very sick from that, and with many residual issues arising from that treatment. What do you think?
I agree completely. I think the tragedy was that by 2007, because of this extraordinarily unusual global environment I've described, and what happened in the financial sector, and the reliance on that, is that policymakers only had terrible choices. There were just nothing but absolutely terrible choices. And this wasn't just true in the U.S. Remember that in the end, all these rescues started under the Bush administration. It was sort of bipartisan response to the disaster. Now, there are two reasons why the economy never really recovers from this sort of thing very quickly. First, the panic itself makes people very, very cautious.
Mm-hmm.
And so businesses are run in a much more cautious way than they used to be. Second, demand is fundamentally weaker than it was before. Fundamentally weaker, because remember that before the crisis, what was juicing up demand, and in America, is a consumer demand-led economy. Remember that.
That's right.
And same is true here in Britain, and also in Europe, in fact. So the consumers used to borrow like crazy in order to spend more than their income. That had to stop. So, of course, the demand stopped. Corporations were cautious. They didn't want to invest.
But Martin, they're still like, here it is.
So that's why we're in this mess for so long.
But 5 years later, they're still like that. And these corporations are still sitting on their cash. They're still not investing in growth. And how much of that... How much of that is because corporate America is not paying attention to the their customers as much as they are at Wall Street? What do you think?
I think there is a good argument to be made that in the U.S. and U.K., which have similar corporate governance structures, the what I think of as stock-linked remuneration.
Yes.
Has led a lot of corporate management, most of whom are there for very, very short periods of time. As you know, the turnover is very high.
Mm-hmm.
They have this sort of once-in-a-lifetime opportunity become seriously rich.
And so
they focus on actions which will raise the stock price.
And their position and their performance is being evaluated every 90 days. You can't make long-term decisions based on a 90-day requirement.
Of course. So they underinvest. There's no doubt about
that's
it.
Thank you very much for saying that. 20 after, right back with Martin Wolf. Stay with us. His book is called The Shifts and the Shocks.
Insperity presents the Small Business Advocate Show with Jim Blasingame. This is a copyrighted production of Small Business Network, Inc., intended for the private use of our audience. Except as otherwise provided by copyright law, all other copying, redistribution, or publication without prior written consent is prohibited. All rights reserved.